Hi folks, welcome to the NozillaCast Mac podcast hosted at Podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Friday the 17th of October, and this is show number 493. I'm your guest host, Bart Bouchotz. You're hearing my voice this week instead of Allison's because Allison and Steve are away at their daughter's wedding. So I'm sure I speak for all of the Nozilla castaways when I wish the happy couple, Lindsay and Nolan, a very long and very happy union. And I'm sure Allison and Steve are having a great time over there. Allison might be away, but don't think that doesn't mean that you're going to hear Allison's voice in this show, because in fact, Allison sent me in two recordings, so you get to listen to her twice. As it happens, actually, the first thing we're going to hear on the show is a review sent in by Allison, which is a review of an app written by a fellow Nozilla castaway, which is really cool. Then after that, you're going to hear me again. I'm going to be answering a dumb question from listener Linda. Then I'm going to hand over to listener Ken Wolf, who sent in a review of an app called Chronicle. And then you're back to me again. I'm going to do an impromptu, somewhat unexpected security light. You may or may not have heard that there's a nasty security bug in HTTPS that's been nicknamed Poodle, which sounds very cuddly and friendly, but it's actually quite dangerous. So I'm just going to explain what it is and, most importantly, how you can protect yourself. And then when you've had enough of me for a while, I'm going to hand over briefly to Allison for a for an ad for Clarify. And then after that, it's going to be me again, this time for Chit Chat Across the Pond, where I talk to George Starcher. And our topic is a big picture view of security from the point of view of a Mac user. So at Security Light, we usually look at, you know, this problem, then this problem, then this problem. Well, I thought, why not talk to a person who makes their living on security about the big picture stuff? So that's what myself and George chat about at the end of the show. So anyway, enough chit-chat from me for now. Let's hand over to Allison.
As usual, you know I can't stay away. I have to interrupt Bart. I hope you're doing a great job, Bart. I have every confidence that you are. Anyway, I wanted to tell you guys a story and something that turned out really, really cool. A little while ago, good friend of the show, Slough, wrote to the Mac Geek Gab boys, Dave Hamilton and John F. Braun, with a very interesting request. Dave included me on distribution in his reply, thinking I might have some ideas. Here's Slough's original question. Hi, Dave and John. I have an issue I've been trying to solve for quite some time. In fact, it would help a great deal of blind Mac users such as me. I'm trying to find a way to move the mouse pointer in fixed increments, pixels, inches, whatever, using only the keyboard or preferably the numeric keypad. While there's a way to move the pointer using mouse keys within the accessibility pane of system preferences, the result is based on factors like delay and speed and vary according to how long you hold down the key, so results aren't repeatable or translatable from user to user. With VoiceOver, it's possible to read the mouse coordinates in inches relative to screen or window, but it's not possible to enter coordinates manually. An example of where moving the pointer manually would be helpful and even necessary is when there are invisible elements on screen that are not recognized by VoiceOver but need to be clicked. One can navigate to the closest recognizable element and then manually move the pointer from there. I'm thinking there might be an Apple script or something that could perform the mouse pointer movement, and it could be triggered by a keyboard shortcut. What do you think? I have to tell you, one of my great joys in life is keeping Dorothy, you know her as Mac Lurker in the chat room, out of the bars by giving her scripting problems to solve. She's like a dog with a bone when she gets a fun project like this and will run it down until she solves it, and she could not be happier the whole time. She and I work out together, so we use that 45 minutes or so on the elliptical to noodle ideas. I talked to her about this problem, and we started by noodling questions on how you would ever figure out distance on a screen since screen resolutions are so very different. If you think about the extreme example, let's say I have a super low-res monitor like 1024 by 768. Everything is way bigger on screen than if you have a modern Retina MacBook Pro set at 1440 by 900. So if I were to tell you that you need to move a half inch to the right, wouldn't that be way farther than on your Mac on what you would need? Well, overall, I contributed very little to this project, but I did find a script written by Jacob Salmela back in 2013 that was designed to send the mouse to a specific location. Some of the commands he was using have since been deprecated, but his work gave Dorothy the seeds on how maybe this could be done. I'm going to fast forward now to the end of the story. Dorothy figured out how to query the Mac you're using to return the screen resolution of the primary display you're using and physical size of that same display. She then programmed in how to translate pixel movement to physical distance. During our testing phase, I made her add a noise to the script using the command afplay that Bart had just taught us a little while ago in Taming the Terminal. It worked great, but I do have to admit that when we shipped the final product to Slough, he said the noises drove him nuts, so we took them out. I told Dorothy she should charge him to take him out. Anyway, Dorothy wrote all of this in AppleScript, put it into Automator to create an application she called MoveMouse. She also created a set of four services called by the application, which need to live in your library services directory. Once these four services are in place, you can assign keystrokes to them using the built-in keyboard shortcuts in System Preferences. Now, ideally, we'd have a double-click installer that would do all of this automatically, but it's one of those things that sounds more complicated than it's when it's described than when you actually do it yourself. All you have to do is put the application in the Applications folder, move the services into the Services directory, and you're done. Now, I'd like to think I did add value to this project, even though Dorothy is actually the one with the brains. One of the huge values I added, though, was to create a really pretty icon for the application that shows a mouse moving diagonally. It's blue. Of course it's blue. They're all blue, right? Yeah, I spent 2 hours creating an icon for an application for the blind. I feel really good about it, though. The application Dorothy wrote, she calls MoveMouse. If you're a blind Mac user and this sounds fun or useful to you, I put a link to two things in the show notes. The first is the installer and license file for MoveMouse. This is not an optional README file. You absolutely will have no clue to do what to do with the files if you don't read at least the installer part. The second is a zip file with the MoveMouse application and the four services all nicely bundled up. Slough says that Dorothy's solution, this little application MoveMouse, does exactly what he needed it to do, and he is delighted, especially now that we took the sounds out for him. I'd like you to give us feedback on whether this works for you and whether it actually solves a real problem for you. All right, Bart, back to you.
Thanks for that, Allison, and thanks to Dorothy for writing such a cool Wii utility. Firstly, this is software by Nasilla Castaways for Nasilla Castaways, and that's just pretty cool, isn't it? It just goes to show that the Nasilla Castaways community is broad, diverse, and very helpful for the rest of the community. Also, I have said a million and one times that I think that if you're a geek, you should learn to program, because if you can program, you have the ability to help people solve problems. So, Allison, you know all those times I've hounded you to learn to program now that you're retired and everything? Yeah, consider yourself hounded again. And anyone who's out there thinking, should I not, will I, won't I, oh, go on, you know you want to. Genuinely, programming is a liberating experience, it's fun. It just lets you make, it lets you become the boss of the computer. And, you know, computers are so much more useful when you're in charge, is what I always say. Anyway, I'll get down off my soapbox now, and let's continue with the next segment of the show.
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Our question this week is from Lister Linda. And unfortunately, I'm the only person here now, so I'm going to have to read this out loud. And I'm really bad at reading out loud, so apologies if this doesn't sound great. Hi Bart, I've heard you say many times that older OSs are not secure because they haven't been updated against current vulnerabilities. Is it possible that some older Mac OS systems, i.e. the first Mac OS 10 version and or OS 9, would actually be secure because no one has written Trojans, worms, etc. that would run on them? Or they might be running really old versions of software that aren't vulnerable to modern exploits. I ask because one of my friends advocates letting some older folks running older Macs run what they have. It's hard for some of the older people to change. I've always advocated having them updated or update, but I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. Thanks, Linda. Okay, well, firstly, Linda, thank you very much for a great question. Not an easy question, but it is a good question. I guess the short version might be, it depends, but you probably want a little bit more than that. Really, at the key of all this is it comes down to balancing risks, and there probably isn't an exact right answer, and there probably isn't sort of a line in the sand you can say, well, from this minute in time, all the software that's older than this is fine, and from this minute of time, it's all good, you know, it's not fine. But we can still have a useful discussion, and hopefully that'll help things. So firstly, I just want to draw attention to the difference between vulnerability and risk. Vulnerability is just sort of a fact, you know. Something is vulnerable or it isn't vulnerable, and it's not open to debate. But risk is something very different, and that is very subjective. It depends very much on the situation, and different people will consider different risks okay. So an analogy I like to use to make the distinction clear is that an unlocked house is always vulnerable, right? The amount of effort it takes for an intruder to get into an unlocked house is effectively zero, so the vulnerability is very high. However, the risk depends really on where your house is. So if you're living in the middle of a large metropolitan area, there's perhaps a high local crime rate, there's lots of people around trying doors, then the risk from the vulnerable door is very, very high. You take that same door, same house, and you put it up a mountain somewhere 100 miles from the nearest road, the vulnerability is identical, but the risk is almost zero. And so old OSs are vulnerable, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the risk is unacceptable. Another important fact to bear in mind for this discussion is that it's actually surprising how old a lot of the code in our operating systems is. Operating systems are built in a very additive sort of way. And so if you were to sort of count line by line by line, you would be amazed that some of the lines of code running our latest shiny OS 10, 10.10 Yosemite, they may date to the 70s. Right? There are probably lines of code in there from the 70s. There are definitely lines of code in there from the 80s. More from the 90s, loads from the 2000s, and bucket loads from the 2010s. So, I mean, you know, why reinvent the wheel, I guess, is the reason for this. You'll often hear of vulnerabilities that go back, way back. So in Windows terms, you might hear a vulnerability that goes all the way back to Windows 3.1. These things happen all the time. The bash thing we talked about last week is a great example of this. That bug goes back over a decade, and it has been in every version of OS X that has used bash all the way back. And the reason I don't say every version of OS X is because the very early versions of OS X used a different shell. But anyway, that vulnerability is so old, it goes back to so many versions, it just cuts everything. On the other hand, if there's a bug found in the new features in 10.10, well, that obviously is only going to exist in 10.10. But it is surprising how far back a lot of our software goes, or the code in our modern operating systems goes. The other thing, I guess, is that the closer in time two operating systems are, the more code they're going to have in common. So that means that actually probably the most dangerous operating systems to run are the ones that are only just not being patched. And that does indeed lead very much to the argument you were saying, where if you start to go the whole way back to OS 10.9, you're actually, the risk curve is definitely, the risks are definitely getting lower as you go really, really far back in time. Being a little bit out of date is very bad. Being way, 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 way out of date is actually safer. Whether or not it's safe enough is debatable, but it's definitely safer. Another really big factor is whether or not the computer is connected to a network and whether or not that network has access to the internet. If a computer is completely isolated from the internet, then that's sort of the digital equivalent of our utterly vulnerable house on a mountain 100 miles from the nearest road. You know, the vulnerability is there, but there's no opportunity for anyone to actually make use of that vulnerability to do something nasty. So a very simple thing is if someone has an old computer they want to keep using, just pull the Ethernet lead out of the back of it or disable Wi-Fi, and then they can safely continue to use it for as long as they like, because there's just no way for the bad guys to get at them, and there's no way for them to stumble onto the internet and accidentally go to a web page that's running some attack against their computer which their browser wouldn't be patched for. So, you know, take them off the internet and the problem to a very, 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 very large extent goes away. At that stage, your only risk is what if someone brings something in on a USB stick or a floppy drive or whatever. But really, that's not such a big risk for Mac users anyway. Now, at this stage, I'm just going to get up on my soapbox and just give you my opinion, right? And this is pure, total, and utter opinion. Everyone is free to disagree with me, to look at the same facts and come to a different conclusion, right? Seriously, opinion. If the person doesn't want to use the internet, I would say do whatever you like. I mean, Allison's mom famously used DOS for years and years and years. Computer wasn't connected to the internet. No problem whatsoever. I couldn't stand DOS, but hey, to each their own. It was great. It worked fine. But if you are going to stick that network lead into the computer, I would say don't be out of date. Being out of date and being on the internet is asking for trouble. And I have made a point. I just drawn a line in the sand, and I have said to friends and family, if you want my support, you will keep your machine patched. Otherwise, I will have nothing whatsoever to do with your machine. And I know people don't like change, and I know change is horrible and evil. But ultimately, if you're going to be on the internet, it is a changing place. And if you're going to be there, you have to be able to accept change. So I literally put it as bluntly as this. If you want to use the internet, you have to be okay with change. There is no two ways about it. It's either no internet or change is okay. And you may say that's harsh, but really, I think it's actually the only way to be properly safe. I'm just not prepared to take bigger risks with people who I like. Friends and family, sorry, but I want them to be safe. I don't want them to be in danger. And that's just where I draw the line. As I say, everyone's free to make up their own mind on this. But for what it's worth, that's my two cents on the matter. Anyway, thank you very much, Linda, for a question with plenty of meat on the bones. Well, now it's time to move on to a review sent in to us by listener Ken Wolfe. I'm going to try to say this right this time. Alison had a good laugh at me off mic last week when I tried to pronounce Manhattan Repertory Theatre and made such a mess of it quite a few times over that we had to restart chit-chat across the pond. Anyway, Ken, thank you very much for sending in your review, and here it is.
Hi, Bart. This is Ken Wolfe from Manhattan Repertory Theatre with a review of Chronicle, a bill reminder app from Little Finn Software, LLC. But first, let's start with the infamous problem to be solved. I, like everyone else, have bills that need to be paid. Now, the problem is I'm old, and so I forget things. And the problem is I'm busy, so I get distracted and I forget things. So I need either an application or a person who will remind me to pay my bills on time. Since I can't afford a personal assistant, Chronicle is my application of choice. The first thing you need to do when you open up Chronicle is to log in the information about your bills. You need to put your due date, the amount, and all those little details. Once in, Chronicle does all the work. The interface is simple and easy to read. On the left, you have your bills with the average paid, the amount that is due, and then the next due date. On the right, you have the month at a glance, and you also have a listing of the bills that are due soon, bills that are due this month in terms of how much it's going to be, and also the bills that you have already paid this month in terms of the amount that you've paid. Down bottom, you can also list your income. When you pay a bill, you simply log in the amount, and then your bill goes down to the bottom of the column on the left. Chronicle has some interesting features. In the preferences, you can set up your overview columns with the average pay, the amount due, the balance, and other things. And you can also set up weekend avoidance, which means that it will show the bill as due on Friday before a weekend. So you don't have to pay a bill on the weekend. You can set up when it will announce that a bill is due soon. It could mean 7 days, it could mean 1 day, or it could mean 12. You set it up so that it works for you. Also, you can set it up so that in the dock or the menu bar, and there's a little number that shows you how many bills are due. You can also enable notification reminders and default reminder settings saying you want it to be reminded maybe 3 days before your bills are due and at a specific time. Basically, you can set up the reminders so that they will work for you. Chronicle also has an iOS app that syncs via Dropbox, and it works seamlessly. The one caveat I have with this application is that when you're logging in bills paid, there will be a voiceover that says, "Good job! Terrific! Well done! Congratulations!" Congratulations? Seriously? You're congratulating me because I am paying my $10.88 Photoshop bill? Hey, I want congratulations when I win an Oscar. So that feature is a little annoying. I just turn the sound down when I am logging in my paid bills. So if you need to be reminded about your bills, please check out Chronicle. It's only $9.99 right now on the Mac App Store. I think it's on sale. And it is a great application, and the iOS app is wonderful also. This is Ken Wolf from Manhattan Repertory Theater in New York City, signing off. And Bart, I just want to say I think you are the greatest and unique. And what you do and your work with Allison and your work on your podcasts and on the other podcasts I've listened to you is awesome. And thanks for covering for Allison this week.
Well, it's a good thing we're doing this on audio only, because if you could see how much I'm blushing now and like bright red and everything. Anyway, thank you very much, Ken. I'm humbled. Irish people have this problem with taking compliments. It's terrible of us and we should all get over it. But anyway, thank you. Okay, folks, now it's time for an unscheduled visit to Security Light. The reason I'm not waiting until next week is actually that this is a bug about which we can do something to protect ourselves. So I thought it would be very silly to have us all be vulnerable for a needless extra week. Anyway, what we're going to talk about here is the vulnerability which has been given the cutesy name of Poodle. I think it's sort of a prerequisite these days. If you're going to have a vulnerability and you want the media to pick up and run with it, you have to give it a cutesy wootsy name. So Poodle it is. Now, Poodle is a bug in the third version, or version 3, of the SSL protocol. So what does that mean? Well, We know that if we see the little lock icon in our address bar in our web browser, that we are working over a secured, i.e. an encrypted connection. And at least that's the theory. Unfortunately, the problem discovered means that that theory isn't always fact. So before we can understand the problem, I need to give a little bit more background information. So whenever you see that lock icon, what that indicates is that you're surfing to that website over the HTTPS protocol, or the secure version of the HTTP protocol. Now, HTTPS is a way of doing encryption, but HTTPS isn't one particular type of encryption. So the HTTPS protocol allows, or requires, in fact, the specification of two things to construct a secure connection. The two ends have to agree on an encryption protocol to use, and they have to agree on an encryption cipher to use. Now, there are a kabillion encryption ciphers, and this bug has nothing to do with ciphers, so I'm going to just ignore the specifics of ciphers for this. What is of interest to us today is the protocols that can be used. And since the HTTPS protocol came into use in 1994, there have been five different encryption protocols supported. So the first of those was SSL version 2, the second one SSL version 3, then there was TLS 1.0, TLS 1.1, and TLS 1.2. In case you're wondering what happened to SSL version 1, SSL version 1 was effectively the test version, the beta version. It was never used for real because it was found not to be perfect, and so the first one to really get used was version 2. Anyway, all very confusing. The problem that's been found this week is in version 3 of the SSL protocol. Now, the nature of the bug is that if the attacker does a little bit of work, it is possible for the attacker to decrypt what is supposed to be an encrypted channel, and that is a really bad thing. Now, the problem that's been found is not a coding bug. It's actually a problem with the design of the protocol. So that means that every single implementation of the SSL v3 protocol is just as vulnerable. It's not that a programmer somewhere made a mistake implementing the spec, it's that the spec was wrong. The spec had a flaw which wasn't noticed, in fairness, for many, many years. I mean, it's, I think, 15 years, I believe, is how old this version of the protocol is. So for 15 years, the bug has existed, but no one realized it. But now it's been discovered, and the bad guys know how to use it. So effectively, what this means is that as of this week, SSL is dead. Long live TLS. Now, for most of us, the demise, the death of SSL version 3 is not an issue, because most of us are using modern web browsers that are perfectly capable of talking TLS 1, TLS 1.1, or TLS 1.2, or probably all of the above. It's also not really a problem for web server administrators. In fact, it really, really shouldn't be a problem for web server administrators, because unless the web server is absolutely bloody ancient, it most certainly can talk TLS and doesn't need to rely on SSL. Now, there is one victim in all of this. I am perpetually amazed at the eternal life that seems to have been granted to Internet Explorer version 6. Well, folks, as of today, or as of this week, rather, IE6 is dead. D-E-D, dead. It does not support TLS. It only knows how to talk SSL. It cannot do HTTPS connections securely anymore. So if you're stuck on Windows XP, you need to get off of IE6, you need to get yourself up to IE8, which is as high as you can go with Windows XP. Or, to be perfectly honest, you need to get yourself up to Windows 7 or over to Linux, really. But anyway, if you absolutely have to stay on XP, you really, really, really need to get off IE6. It is deceased. It is no more. It is an X browser. Okay, so now let's move into the security light, actually protecting ourselves bit. So to understand how we can protect ourselves, I need to explain a little bit more about what's going on under the hood when you see that little lock icon in your URL bar. So I've said that the HTTPS protocol allows for multiple encryption protocols to be used, and those protocols will use multiple encryption ciphers. But how is it decided what protocol to use? Well, the answer is, it's negotiated. So when you type in, say, www.facebook.com, and hopefully with a HTTPS in front of it, your browser is talking to Facebook's web server over HTTPS. And before that connection starts, there's a sort of a setup phase, an initialization. And during that initialization, the two sides, the browser and the server, negotiate the specifics of how they're going to talk over HTTPS. And as a part of that negotiation, it's agreed upon which version of TLS or SSL to use and which cipher to use. And the way that works is that your browser in its headers and the requests sends a list of what it supports. Basically, it says, I support these versions of TLS, these versions of SSL, and all of these encryption ciphers. The server gets that and it goes, oh, okay, well, what do I know? Ah, well, I know how to do this version of SSL, this version of TLS, and all of these ciphers. So how's about we agree to do TLS version 1.1 using the ORC4 cipher or whatever? And then away the connection goes and off we go. Now, the important point here is that it's a negotiation. What that means is that if either side objects to the use of SSL, SSL can't be used. And that means that we can protect ourselves by making our browsers refuse to talk SSL, and webmasters can protect everyone who visits their website, even if their browser hasn't been configured properly, to be safe by the server side deciding to refuse to talk SSL. So conscientious webmasters have spent an awful lot of time this week reconfiguring their web servers to tell them that SSL is not okay and they are only to use TLS. Anyway, like I said last time, buy a sysadmin a coffee because he or she is almost certainly in need of one. But let's switch over now and look at it from our point of view. So the first thing to say is that browser manufacturers are working on updates because obviously they can simply change the code in the browser so they don't talk SSL and the problem goes away. But we're in danger right now this second on every single secure website we visit. Maybe it's not as secure as we think. So that means we should protect ourselves and we shouldn't wait for the browser vendors to come out with their updates. So instead, I have put a link in the show notes to a page with instructions which tell you how to turn off SSL in different browsers. And so I would say go to the page, click on the instructions for the browser you use, protect yourself, and then all is well. So maybe pause the podcast and do it now. This really is a big deal. Anyway, that's probably enough of me rattling on about this, so let's get on with the rest of the show.
Hey, it's me back again. So the other night, my friend Melanie sends me this frantic message that she and her sisters have been texting back and forth, but all of a sudden, her iPhone is not getting any of these text messages. She's convinced that she's doing something stupid, but I explained to her that messages on iOS is just stupid. Sometimes it works, and then all of a sudden it just doesn't work right. And I told her to tell her sisters to just delete the message string, the whole thread, and just start over. And she was really, really happy because that fixed the problem. So then she sent me an email and said, hey, want to go for two? This is a new dilemma that she has. She said when she played music in iTunes, she had sound. If she plays a video in iPhoto, she has sounds. But for some reason, anything she opens in Safari had no sound. Well, I had no idea what was causing this, but I spent, 35 seconds on the Googles, and I found out that for some reason, the, what is it called? The power-saving feature in Safari can sometimes cause, I think it's Flash, but some sites to not be able to play audio. So it wasn't really complicated to fix this. You go into Safari Preferences, you click on the Advanced tab, and you uncheck the box that says Internet Plugins. Now, with an unsophisticated user, you know I would have gotten a call back going, what? What did you just try to tell me to do? So you know what I did. I whipped up and clarify. I took a screenshot of the pull-down menu using a time screenshot. I drew a giant arrow pointing to the Advanced tab, and then I drew a box around Internet Plugins and said, uncheck this. Basically took me about 35 seconds more to do this, and I was able to paste it into an email back to her, and I solved her problem. She has now decided that I am her hero for life. You too can be a hero like this if you check out Clarify from clarify-it.com. Hey, they got a free trial. They got a new version. It's all good. Go check it out. And again, back to you, Bart.
It's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond. And yeah, no, this isn't Alison. This is Bart. So joining me, instead of joining Alison, is a name I think some of the Nosilla castaways will know. It's George Starcher. Welcome, George.
Hey, Bart. Yeah, I guess since you're hosting over there, it still technically is across the pond since I'm over here where she would have been. So
yeah, we've changed direction. We're going the other way.
Yep.
Now, I remember you very well from Victor's shows as Victor's pocket security guy. And then you also joined us on the International Mac podcast a few times. So just for the any Nosilla castaways who haven't met you, do you just want to sort of give a brief description of, what has you into security?
Yeah. Well, of course, I've been around the Mac community for, god-awful long, and since podcasting, since it started. So, I've helped been obviously a part of Victor's show for a long time till that retired, and I helped Ken Ray with his live call-in show until that part of the show retired. And, of course, I've been doing security work for probably 15, 20 years of one form or another. Yeah. So, yeah, I do pretty much information security now for, like, a hosting company these days. So, actually, you know, my commute consists of rolling out of bed, walking past the door, letting the dogs out, making the loop past my Keurig machine to get my cup of coffee, and then I jump on my work MacBook Pro hooked to a Thunderbolt display and, and you know, go to town for the rest of the day.
Sounds good. So you're actually a security pro, whereas I'm someone who has to know about security for my job, but my job isn't security.
Yeah, my job is actually security.
Yeah. Actually, I kind of find the security stuff some of the most fun of my job, but they still don't pay me to do that full time. Anyway, so every, you know, the regular Nasilla Castaway listeners know that every second week I do Security Light, where we talk about the news, and it's very much, you know, looking at individual trees in the forest that is security. This thing happened, it means this. And I thought it would be fun to get someone like yourself on to actually zoom out and look at the big picture. You know, okay, so Mac users, what is the security landscape like? You know, what should we be afraid of? What shouldn't we be afraid of? What's out to get us? You know, big picture stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, ironically, you know, having done this a lot with the Mac podcast over the years, the general advice is not considerably different than it always has been. It may be in some ways easier to do some of the things as the iterations of the operating system have made the full disk encryption, for instance, way more stable than it used to be.
Yeah.
You know, so some of those things, but for the most part, it hasn't changed. I mean, certainly Apple's a lot more popular than it used to be, so it's much more targeted. And the honest truth is so many security people, so many researchers all use Macs as their primary computer because it's just the right mix of usability and Unix related, you know, behavior, you know, compared to like Windows and stuff that it's pretty much what everybody uses. And because you can always spin up virtual machines and do other things as well. But
yeah, it's very noticeable when you go to tech conferences that, you know, if you're up on stage presenting, when you look down in the audience, all the little white apples shining back out at you.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, so for the most part, the things are this, especially if you look at some of the things that have been in the news lately, like that that iWorm thing, which really the only reason I think I told Adam this, Adam Christensen, because sometimes I do stuff with him and I said, I have no idea other than link bait why someone called that thing iWorm, because it's not a worm. It's a Trojan.
I was going to say, my theory on that is someone wanted to sell some AV.
Yeah, it was link bait, right? Because a worm means it self-propagates, and it was very clear that it didn't do that. It was in pirated software, which means it's a Trojan, which basically means, as a rule, as long as you're staying patched, the real risk to your own machine and your data is you.
The squishy organic bit is where we come back to again and again, isn't it?
Right. So don't run as admin. You know, set up a backup extra admin account on your machine. Make sure you're locking your devices, both whether they're iDevices or the Macs, with the screen locks. Use the full disk encryption. Of course, that's automatic on iOS when you start locking the device. And with Macs, you just go and turn on File Vault, which again is pretty much transparent these days.
Yeah, and it's actually really nice how smooth that experience is since they stopped doing it with, didn't they used to do what, like your home folder went into a container and all this?
Oh God. Yeah. It was awful. And then of course getting it to back up with Time Machine was a thing because it was always open. So it never truly backed up and, you know, all that's been solved. Right. So the best thing though, is if you do turn that on, take a screenshot of the recovery key and go put that as a secure note attachment in whatever password vault you like, whether that's LastPass or 1Password, whatever, and make sure it's synced into your password vault so it's across your devices. So that if something happens and you need that key, or something happens to you and your relative or spouse or whatever needs that key, then they can get into the device.
Yeah, and I actually would say, you know, consider printing it out and keeping it somewhere where you keep all of those things that your significant other needs to have. In case.
Yeah, exactly. Go lock it up in your safe deposit box in a sealed folder, you know, sort of thing, just so that they don't have to deal with the digital thing.
And, you know, from a day-to-day usage point of view, the only thing you'll notice when you do that is that the login screen moves to the BIOS. So you log in and then your machine boots instead of your machine booting and then you log in.
Sure. So, but that, and that'll, that mitigates a ton of risk, obviously, if you do that. Because I know when I was working for the past 2 years, I worked at a university. And whenever someone said my Mac was stolen, they were like, you know, did you have encryption turned on? Did you have, you know, find my iPhone or find my Mac turned on? And were you auto locking the screen? You know, those were always the questions we asked every time. Yeah. And, you know, if you wanted to have any chance of finding it at all. So keep it patched. Don't run as admin. Turn on those locks and security features. And don't download software from untrusted sources. You know,
which sounds awfully like what we've been saying for the last 15 or 20 years.
Yeah, it pretty much has not changed. The only thing that has changed, in my opinion, is that I love Apple. Mm-hmm. The only bloody Microsoft thing left in this house is my Xbox 360, which I rarely turn on. But my honest opinion, as much as I love them, the quality of stuff that's been coming out lately is a bit concerning. And some of the decisions they made, like the whole shell shock thing, right, that came out, which is the ability of someone to run terminal commands on your machine remotely, right? That's in essence what that was.
Yeah, I mean, I know Apple said that if you leave the Mac in its default configuration, there's no way for someone to get at bash from the outside. Okay, great.
Sure,
but you've patched it. It's a couple of K. Would you give it to us, for goodness sake?
Yeah, that's the thing. They didn't put it into automatic update, and they still don't have it in automatic update. And just in the past 7 days, someone has released a proof of concept where they can make reverse DNS execute the vulnerability against a Mac. So,
that's through MDNS responder or something, is it?
It's like reverse DNS lookups where you like take an IP back to a name.
So that means bind on OS X is vulnerable if you can make it look up the wrong IP.
Yeah, basically, if someone sends you the right crafted web page stuff, they can cause your Mac to reverse DNS lookup the thing. And it's a proof of concept, but it's possible, right? And the fact that they're not auto pushing it is a big pain, you know, because where I work, we hand out freaking Thunderbolt displays and MacBook Airs. And so that's what everyone gets. And getting everyone to patch their stuff, even in a technical company, is sometimes difficult.
Well, patches make you reboot. Patches make you close apps. I mean, I swore quite loudly at Microsoft today when they insisted that I shut down Firefox and Safari so I could update Excel.
Yeah, yeah. But reboot your life if all your data gets out. Good luck with that.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I know this, but I don't know this. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, so, I know it at a theoretical level, and yet when I get presented with the pop-up window, my temptation is the same as everyone else's, to click the later button.
Yeah, yeah.
Remind me tomorrow.
Don't disagree. It certainly is, you know, a matter of convenience, but it's just something you need to do. And I just wish they would, you know, as much resources they have, and it's granted, it's not like they're making a lot of clear security mistakes, you know, like some others do, or especially like web services are doing.
Could you argue they've gotten a bit better? Because they seem to be at least more timely. There used to be times when we would talk about a Samba vulnerability going unpatched for 3 months.
Oh, sure. And there's still plenty of unpatched zero day that researchers have told Apple that's still there. But my concern is things like 8.0.1. and what it did to phones. You know, there's signs of being sloppy.
Well, what it did to phones is bad. And, okay, so on the one hand, it was sloppy, which it was. On the other hand, they did at least respond promptly. But what worries me about that is that people are going to become suspicious of updates, which means people are going to stay vulnerable for longer.
Which we've seen with the reduced uptake number of 8.
Yeah, it's hovering about half.
Yeah, so the people who've gone to 8.0.2 is not what previous versions have been in terms of where they are at this point in time, because now we've, you know, burned everybody's hand and they're going, fine, I'm just not going to do it. It's not that big a deal. It doesn't, you know, I can't have my phone not work. So that, and then in turn creates issues. But on the other side, you know, I'm proud of Apple making, you know, after, especially with, you know, the 8.0.1, 8.1.2, making a stand with law enforcement and saying, you know, we're setting
We talked about this with Allison last week, but I'm having so much... Well, fun isn't probably the right word, but I find it quite pleasing to watch American law enforcement lose their reason over some security.
And they're making absurd things. You know, like the guy that runs the FBI at risk of putting some relationships at risk. But, that's insane. You know, they're not fostering,
security does not mean criminality.
No, it does not. And the fact that if you had been doing your job as law enforcement and defending the Constitution and following, proper warrants all along, then maybe I wouldn't feel the need to defend myself, right, against them.
Yeah.
I got plenty of friends that are in there, and I say that to their face,
I think it was the police chief in, I think it was Chicago with the fantastic line, oh, the iPhone is now the phone of choice of pedophiles. Like, great. You've just undermined your entire credibility, mate.
Yeah. Especially when, they can fall back to the, process that they've used for the past 50 years, which is they issue a warrant. They get the device. They can't get into it. The judge tells the guy to turn over access. And if he fails, he's in contempt and goes to jail.
It's not that they're losing powers they had. It's that they're losing powers they shouldn't have had, but they took for themselves.
Exactly. That is my opinion, too. But back to the Apple thing. Yes. The average user, stay patched. Don't run as admin.
Stay patched, right? Just to clarify, it's not only the Apple updates you have to click OK to, right?
Sure, yeah. You want to update your apps too, right?
And what would be the biggest danger points? Which updates would you rank as being the most don't delay updates?
Well, obviously anything that's related to your banking or your password controls. Anything that's, the keys to the kingdom, right? Either money or identity. Okay. I would make sure those apps you update before anything. And also, too, anything that's taking too many liberal permissions with access to your contacts and your location and stuff, give those another hard look.
So the more privilege an app has into your computer, the more important it is. And I guess something that touches the internet is probably more dangerous than something that doesn't.
Yeah, sure.
So Flash.
Yeah. Or all these dime a dozen keyboard inserts that everyone's throwing on their iPhones. No, thank you. I might trust Smile, but I ain't just trusting Joe Bob, Billy Bob with his emoji keyboard. Sorry.
I don't believe Smile actually needed to ask for extra permissions, did they? Their keyboard, or did it?
No, it did. I don't know if it still does, but it did initially because something about like the sounds and the auto express, stuff. Oh, okay. So you did have to give it the full permission for it to work properly, at least initially.
I must double check. I could have sworn it didn't, but Swipe did.
No, I could have sworn I had to do it to make mine work, but maybe it was just early. I literally downloaded it the moment it released and was playing with it because it was, it was Text Expander. I wanted it.
Yes, yes. It's been one of the biggest missing features in iOS, really.
Yeah, yeah. The only problem is, too, is that the way Apple designed that with not giving them access to the autocorrect means that even though I bought it, I hardly ever use the keyboard because I type significantly faster on the native keyboard than Text Expander. So I save it for special use where I really need to expand out a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, I tend to find it more useful actually on the iPad than on the iPhone.
Yeah, I would agree because you're probably doing a lot more writing there.
Yeah, my iPhone is very much a triage device. I read email and put little flags next to it. Yeah. And then I get out a bigger device and do stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, so patchy, patchy, patch, patch. That's a clear message so far. Encrypt, if you can. That's a clear message so far. Assuming we patch our stuff, and assuming we've done the full disk encryption, what's the most likely way we're likely to stray into danger as your average Mac user?
Syncing your data to services that don't protect it. We saw just the...
George, I lost you there for a moment. Can I just get you to go back to just your start to that answer?
Yeah. You bounced. I don't know why it was, but you came right back. It was really weird. Do I still sound okay?
No, nope, perfect.
Okay. It just took a second for it to recover. So you asked...
biggest danger?
Yeah. Syncing your data to other services that you don't control, or using the same credential across multiple of those. So, you know, you look at the stuff that came out about Dropbox lately, and everyone was at first on Twitter, oh no, Dropbox has been hacked. And it really wasn't them.
Yeah.
It was either, it's either a third party that ties to a lot of Dropbox accounts, or, and probably even more likely, it was some service that had those accounts, and these guys then tested those accounts against Dropbox for password reuse. So that's why you want to use a password. I mean, I simply do not know my passwords across sites. I have hundreds upon hundreds of passwords in my one password, and I just let it do it, you know?
The passwords I actually know are basically a tiny handful. The one to actually log into my Mac with, the one to unlock my 1Password, and the one for Dropbox so that I can get to 1Password anywhere when I'm not on my own computer.
Right. And on those services like Dropbox, if they offer it, turn on 2-factor. Just do
2FA,
it.
2FA, yeah.
Yeah, whether it's a text. I mean, granted, there's ways for the really bad guys to get in the middle of that. But for the most part, you're going to pretty much take yourself off those big breach lists if you do that. So, and again, too, keep in mind, you know, how that data is getting up there. You know, the whole, I'm syncing all my data to Dropbox, and the government could theoretically get that with a warrant that also has a gag order. So I don't know they took it, but if I'm using File Transporter and I'm seeing, you know, and I control the device, then it would be more difficult for them to get it.
Or if you encrypt stuff before you put it into your Dropbox.
Exactly. If you fully encrypt it in like a, you know, an encrypted disk image before you drop it in, things like that, then that they certainly would have to work to get into the file. So, because that's the thing too, that goes back to that statement about law enforcement. Oh no, the device is encrypted. Yeah, but you know, it's all backed up to iCloud, and
so we just ask out.
my mails and, you know, Gmail, it's a Google Apps based account. You just go get it from them because you've got 99% of the data on the device is not really on the device. The device is a window to it or a local cache. So they've got plenty of other ways. That's just, it's almost like, I'm going to complain about this so you don't see what I'm doing over here. But yeah, so it comes down to that. So protect your online data as best you can. Make, you know, if things ask for security questions, make up those answers and put them in a secure note and for that particular site and your password thing. Don't use ones that they can actually just farm out of your Facebook data, stuff like that. You know, these days, really, I'm more concerned with the non-law enforcement and when I say non-malicious, the quote-unquote criminal element. I'm more concerned with the freaking vendors, you know, tracking my device and tracking me across sites and, you know, Facebook tracking even when you're not logged in and what they do with that data, because they are civil entities. You have no constitutional protections against them.
I think... Well, yeah, and that's certainly true in the U.S. I think in Europe laws are slightly different, but I'm still not sure that makes you that much better off.
Yeah, you have much better laws over there, but also, but are they really doing it? You know?
I mean, you know, within a purely Irish company is almost certainly behaving according to Irish law, which is that you, so according under Irish law, I own my data and a company which has my data is holding it for me. And therefore, they have all these strict rules governing what they can do, which is, works really well from me as an Irish person dealing with an Irish company. But you bring the internet in, and that kind of doesn't really hold up anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And again, you get the bigger companies that are too big to be prosecuted.
Yeah. Although, actually, strangely enough, if you watch carefully at all the news stories about, you know, so-and-so is happening to Facebook in Europe, you'll find that the place that almost always starts is the Irish Data Commissioner's Office.
Oh, that's cool.
Because Facebook have headquarters here, and we have a very active data protection commissioner.
No, that's nice.
So he has standing, and then he usually escalates it to the European courts, and that's usually how it gets up.
And the prods against those companies really are coming out of Europe, you know, like the Google right to forget and stuff like that. And, you know.
A right to forget is a controversial one to pick as an example, but because I
yeah, but I'm just saying in terms 20 times in terms. Yeah, the debate of whether it is or isn't viable is one thing, but the fact it was Europe that actually made Google do something.
Right, yes, that's what you mean, yes.
where they didn't even bat an eye and would never have even bought, it would have never even happened over here. They would have bribed somebody, you know, or lobbied, I guess is the formal word in the U.S. for that. You know, they would have killed it on the vine, right? It would have never made it far enough.
Europe is an interesting place sometimes, but you know, there's an awful lot of bureaucracy, but good stuff does come out of it sometimes.
Yeah, but there's also not a lot of, to protect. I mean, you could take a Raspberry Pi and a couple of, you know, adapters like a Bluetooth and or one of the Uber radio, you know, the you know, some of the USB software defined radios, and you can make your own tracker that, you know, as people walk by your house, and you can pick up patterns and names. And
speaking of your house, it hasn't been said in this discussion, but we probably should say it, even though we have been saying it for 15 years. Encrypt your wireless.
Oh, God, yes.
I mean, I know, arguably it should go without saying, but does it?
Yeah, yeah, encrypt your wires. And it's not because, and the ironic thing is probably the biggest risk isn't that someone's eavesdropping on what you're doing, because the powers that care enough to do that can do that to you anyway. Mm. It's that what you don't want is some bozo getting on your open Wi-Fi and doing something illicit that comes back to you.
Yeah, and the feds come knocking your door down.
Your door, and take your computers, and you take 6 months to prove it wasn't you, but your neighbor that eats you. And not saying they haven't been able to prove that in some cases, but why put yourself through it? Just lock the bloody thing up to begin with. And that whole thing about, you know, oh, I'm going to do the, you know, the MAC address locking.
Fiction. There's no
point. Yeah, you can do it, but there's no point. Because if you've encrypted it, they can't get in anyway. And yeah, if they can break the MAC address filtering, they've already got the tools, and they can, you know, that's so trivial to bypass anyway.
Yeah, to me, MAC address filtering is equivalent to a, you know, keep out sign.
Yeah,
it's effective as it is. It's not a lock. Yeah,
it's not even a latched screen door, really.
Yeah, yeah, because the MAC address is in every single packet flying over the air, so you just watch it.
It has to be. You can't even encrypt it, or the whole networking thing wouldn't work.
Yeah, because you have to be able to say, this is this device talking to that access point. So if you encrypt it, suddenly the access point goes, well, there's no one talking to me.
Yep.
Yes, and so MAC address locking is fiction. It's you know, it's just faux security. And if you're still using WEP, wherever you are, stop.
Yeah, that's, again, too, anyone that wants to get in your stuff will just break it and then use you as that's even worse, right? Because if they got just enough skills to break it,
yeah,
which doesn't take much. It's a lot of point and click stuff these days. But what that does say is they've got the motivation to use your connection for something that is much more likely to come back to you.
Yes.
Yeah. So
if you're lucky, it's just someone looking for some free bandwidth.
Yeah, but they could just go get that at an open hotspot. Why would they need to break yours?
Yeah, I suppose those days are kind of gone, really, isn't it? Because there was a time when I live in a student town. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so you could have a street with, you know, 10 houses of students and 10 houses of, you know, normal families. And the normal families would all pay for internet subscription. And many of the students would never pay for internet and simply look for someone with a WEP, crack it, and then have internet.
Yep.
You know, they wouldn't be doing anything nefarious apart from the hacking and stealing.
Yeah, and guess where? And the DMCAs, you know, go right back to those people that own the house and pay the bill, not the student.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, that's a good point. Actually, even if it's something as simple as stealing movies, you know, why get the six strikes or whatever that rule is against you when you can get the six arcs against your neighbor with WEP?
Exactly.
Yes. So protect your Wi-Fi. Actually, here's a question. Now, this is a genuine question. Mac users and antivirus. Thoughts?
Again, if you're exercising good, you know, you're not admin, you're not installing bizarre stuff from places you don't trust or that you're trying to get away from paying for, and you're patching, you can generally, obviously you can get away with it. I don't run it. Mm-hmm. But if you think that, especially if you've got kids and you don't know what they're going to do to those machines. I mean, we already know they're incubators for germs. I mean, how many times do you get sick because you got kids because they got something and all they did was make it stronger before it jumped into you? You know, the same thing probably applies to your computers. I mean, I remember once we had a guy that worked for us this was like probably 15 years ago. And I never let him live it down because his teenage son took his work laptop the night before he had a presentation to the CEO and a bunch of surfed a bunch of really bizarre porn. It hijacked his default homepage. He came in, got on the network, fortunately before he had his presentation before the executives. So it triggered all my alarms. And I'm like, you know, walk up to him and I just go, moo. So it gives you an idea how crazy the porn was, right? And he's like, what? I said, dude, your machine's spewing all this traffic. And I said, go into things it shouldn't. I said, and we look and his default homepage had been hijacked and all this. Yeah. And basically he figured out it's because his son had, you know, had snuck off at night with the laptop and done whatever. And
That can be very dangerous. I mean,
yeah. Had I not spotted that before the big presentation, some of that stuff might have come up on a big, you know, projector on a wall. And
was there not a teacher in the United States who actually ended up in prison for like a few months because something similar had happened?
And in front of kids, yeah. Then you run the risk of you're suddenly a sexual predator in front of kids. That's lovely, yeah. But obviously, if you're dealing with kids. If it's your own machine and your habits are good and ultimately you can't protect yourself from everything. No. I mean, they've had to tell Congress before, don't read the Drudge Report for 2 weeks because the ad network that has the embedded ads in the Drudge Report is compromised. And they love going after ad networks. I saw it all the time for 2 years at the university. Most of the stuff I bought was coming in through ad networks. And so you could avoid all those illicit sites, but still be completely owned by drive-by malware. But drive-by malware has a harder time if you're patched and not admin because it makes it a much harder time to take root.
Yeah, the drive-by tries to run. It's looking for something to get its claws into and latch onto your computer.
Yeah, and it kind of bounces off or bounces off partially and then, you know, enough to get you time to clean it up. So if you're kind of at risk and you've kind of had weird things happen, maybe you do the AV, but you can live without it as long as you're doing all those other things properly.
I've chosen for my the family members whom I look after, I've put Clamex AV on their machines because it doesn't cost them any money and I feel a little safer knowing that they have that little parachute there just to protect
them. I've even known people that just they won't do anything but the banking through the app on their iPad because that's significantly harder to breach than and not do it on their desktop computer.
It's actually a really good idea because any of this sort of cross-site scripting stuff that may be in there, there's nothing can get cross-site at it when it's on your iPad.
Yeah, it's significantly. Yeah,
well, not the barrier.
I'm not saying there's probably not some clever something somewhere, but the average stuff that's going to auto run and do all the automatic stuff that you could never tell is happening is going to have a significantly harder time. Again, too, if you're also not jailbroken.
That's a very good point, yes.
Don't jailbreak because you are basically saying, hey, I'm going to download the OS to my device from the internet from someone I don't know
and turn on and I'm going to
completely trust it not to be owned either by intent or by accident, you know, and expose your data that way. So
I mean, and the code signing and the stuff Apple have built into iOS is a significant security barrier. It's not impenetrable because nothing is impenetrable.
Sure.
It's a hurdle, right? It's a significant hurdle for attackers.
Yes, it is.
And the only way you can the process of jailbreaking is ripping down all those defenses so that you can go in and do whatever you want. But if you can go in and do whatever you want.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that's pretty much how I do it. And so you can run without AV. Just do all the other things right. Don't screw it up. And if you got kids, you probably can't trust them to do it right. So
I guess parental controls then is probably something else that perhaps people with kids should consider.
Absolutely, especially on the newer updated family features with iOS 8. I tell my friends all the time, I got a couple friends down in Alabama, and they're like, their girls are starting. One of them just reached teen. The other one's not too far behind. I'm like, you're going to have to get them phones. Don't cheap out and get some crappy Android that's never going to get security patches. Go ahead and bite the bullet, get the iOS device, turn on the parental features, put yourself in Find My Friends and lock it so they can't take you out.
Yeah.
You know, I said, it, be honest that you're doing it. Yeah. And tell them that it's that way you don't have to call them as much. You know. And it's not, and you won't even really bother looking long as they show up when and where they say they will, you know, and that way you trust but verify, right?
If it works for nuclear weapons, it should be okay for kids.
Exactly. You know, at least give it a shot, you know, and see how it goes with your particular kid, because obviously every situation is different. But, you know, again, I'm not saying they're not parental controls on other devices, but we know what they are on Apple. They've had a long time to do it. They care, and they're only getting better. So me, I would rather spend the money. And if I had kids, that's what I would do. I'd spend the money, do it right, get them on there, implement those features, and run with it.
And sort of looking at things from the opposite side for a second. So we know we have a pretty good idea of what we should all be doing to protect ourselves. Patch. You know, maybe run AV, maybe don't. You know, all the stuff we've talked about so far, encrypt your wireless, encrypt your devices. But, I mean, you work in the security community, so you see things going wrong. So I guess the question I'd be curious about is, in the real world, what's biting people the most often?
Sharing permissions to devices, like iDevices. Because think about it. Again, you come back to the Find My, like we just said about the kids, put yourself in the Find My Friends and don't, you know, fix it so they can't take you out. You could just as easily if, let's say, and I gave talks to incoming freshmen at the university on security, and I threw in a bunch of their own stuff. That way, when they became employees, if they did, they would then treat our devices the same way. And one of the things I told them is, lock your device and don't give out that password to your boyfriend or girlfriend. I don't care whether you trust them or not. All it takes is one jilted one, because guess what? You can go into Find My Friends. So if I took your device, I could go ahead and set up the pairing while you're not looking, and then take myself back out of your phone. But you're still friended to me, so I can still see where you are. Ooh, now, doesn't mean you couldn't tell. Especially if iOS 8, if you go under location and privacy, it'll tell you who your friends are. But if you don't know that someone did that behind your back and you don't go look.
Yeah, it might be months before you end up in that screen.
The whole time they know exactly where you are. And you don't know that they know exactly where you are.
Yeah.
So there are ways you can misuse it if you're, you know, that control.
And that goes, I guess, for passwords in general, not just, you know, to obviously specifically for something as powerful as the key to get into your iOS device.
Well, look at exactly.
Even website passwords, like your Facebook password or anything like that, that's also very dangerous.
Absolutely. And look at the whole thing that happened with, you know, the whole celebrity photo leakage thing. Right. Where Apple finally, because, you know, everyone says, oh, well, Apple only knew about this for months. Bull. Yeah. We all knew about it for years. That if I had your iTunes account password, I could log in. I could use the backup at mechanism, you know, through like Elcom Sauce tool.
Yes.
And literally suck your iTunes, your iDevice backup out. And then I could just, since literally like the iMessages database is nothing but a SQLite database.
And that's, you know, a SQLite client, I think Firefox can get a plugin to read those.
Yeah, yeah. You could just hook to it with any SQLite interface and do a query against the tables and boom, there's all the text messages. So, you know, and pictures and all of that stuff. So it's not been a secret in the security and law enforcement community,
point is they do need your password, so they can't go straight to iCloud and just take your stuff.
There are ways
of,
they either got to have your password or they have to have taken the trust token, you know, out of iTunes, your device, and then plug your device into their iTunes and do a manual backup or something like that. But the point is Apple's at least now starting to do that. Now, they need to go a step further and do like Google does and show you where your successful logins came from. Because, you know, if you go to Gmail, you can see that. So right now, you can't tell the log of the activity against your account.
That's true, actually. I should be able to go to appleid.apple.com and just see what IP addresses have logged in as me. And if I see anything that's not...
Yeah, but they don't provide that.
They don't, yeah. And I'm just thinking if they did, that would be amazing. So they
should. Yeah, they need to do that. And so, I mean, they've come a long way with turning on the two-factor and making it email you and all this stuff that they've done in the past several months. But prior to that, it was wide open. And again, if you had told your boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever your password and you're a crazy college student, then nothing kept them from going and pulling down your data.
And to this day, you wouldn't know.
And to this day, you would not know.
Sobering thought.
So don't give out that control. I mean, your phone and your mobile device has so much data about you. It is you. And you need to protect it accordingly. I mean, granted, if you're, you know, married, your significant other, maybe you make their fingerprint, you know, backup so they can get into it in the event of emergency. That's a different situation, right?
But yeah, and spouses is different to boyfriend and girlfriend.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, so crazy teenagers in love, you know.
You know, when you get to the marriage stage, you have a legally binding contract there.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah, exactly. So you know that your concerns are different, but the point is, but if you're in a situation that's going badly, you do need to go check your privacy settings and make sure they haven't done simple tricks like friended you in the location tracking and that they're there and you just don't know it, you know. Yeah. Doesn't mean don't use those features because you want Find My iPhone in case, you know, you left it in your back pocket of your other jeans and left them, on the floor.
I am ashamed to say how often I have had to make my phone make that beeping noise.
Dude, one time, it was like a year ago, my wife calls me. She's at work and she works at a pediatric dentist office and I hear him in the background. She goes, I can't find my phone, you know, and it was iPhone 5S, so it's real slim. She didn't have it in the case at the time. I can't find it. Can you make it make that sound? Click, 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 click. Suddenly over the phone, I hear ding, ding, and I hear laughter just erupt. It was in the back pocket of her scrubs. Because it was so thin, you know, a 5S with no case, she didn't feel it and realize it was in her pocket. And to this day, they haven't let her live that down.
I haven't done quite that bad, but I did find that in the between the couch cushion and the couch of the couch I was sitting in.
Yeah, yeah. But the advantage to Find My iPhone, I mean, like I had this discussion with my boss just this morning. He was like, my other coworker asked him about how do you find your device if you misplaced it? And he's like, well, I could just call it. And I said, yeah, but you want to use Find My iPhone because if you just call it and the ringer was off, you don't hear it. But Find My iPhone will actually bypass the silence.
Yeah, I remember in the iPhone, the pre-Find My iPhone days, I remember having that terrible discussion. Ring my phone, it is ringing.
Oh God! Yeah, I left but it's inside. On silent.
Yeah, and that, you know, an hour of ripping the house apart.
Yeah.
Because did I have it before? Did I have it when I got home from work, or is it in work? Or did I lose it on the street? Do I need to go cancel it? Horrible.
Yeah, but it is, again, there are privacy features, the ability to see who's in those lists. And the ability to set it to expire, like now with iOS 8. I mean, you could do it with Find My Friends before, but with iOS 8, just in a text message, you can say, share my location at the end of the day, which being in Vegas with a bunch of friends was real handy because every day I just reshare my location with them. And that way you could tell, you know, who's in whatever on the strip or whatever want to meet up. And then it would just expire out. And, you know, after we were all gone out of Vegas, I didn't have to worry about it anymore. It just took care of itself. So, you know, check those things.
Yeah. And actually, that's one of the ways iOS has improved a lot over the years is that privacy tab is just growing in what it does.
Mm-hmm. And again, too, key is keep control of the device because if you're not locking it, physical control trumps everything. And if they can get into your device because they saw your unlock, 4-digit unlock code, which is easy to read over someone's shoulder, or you're not locking it at all. And that's like I had to tell Ken Ray that once. You know, it was back in the days when he still resisted locking him. And I said, dude, think of your friends. You've got several high profile public people's contacts in your phone. Yeah. This isn't about protecting you. It's about protecting their trust because they entrusted you, you know, like Roddenberry and Claymore and all that. You know, that you've got their information in your phone.
And so, yeah, if you accidentally...
Soon as I pointed that out to him, he turned locking on.
Yeah. No, it's true, yeah. Actually, the other thing, of course, is that our Macs now have a privacy menu as well. And with the magic of Wi-Fi, our Macs can also be used to track us if we have a laptop.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, check the whole Find My Mac and turn that on. And again, too, turn on the locking. Yeah.
Okay, well, we've been going now for over half an hour. So I'm just wondering, is there anything that you think we should have hit on that we've missed in our somewhat meandering conversation?
No, I think we've pretty well covered it. I mean, again, a lot of those basic items have not really changed. but they have gotten easier. So if you ever resisted doing them because you felt they were difficult, especially with the level of, you know, now there's been much more pointed examples of it going wrong, yeah. You know, revisit them. They're really, especially, you know, password, things like 1Password stuff, just make password management and things so much easier. And Touch ID on the devices makes that so much easier. There's no reason to have a 4-digit unlock code. Use a couple of words you know, maybe add a couple of digits so it's easy to remember, but significantly hard to type because you really only got to type it when you reboot the device, and after that, Touch ID takes over.
So, or go to xkpassivity.net and have my automatic generator pick some random words for you.
Yeah, yeah. Just and then make sure you save it in your password vault because yes. I did that one. I told that story to the students once right after I got my 5S. I had there was an update, and of course caused it to reboot.
Yeah.
And I was just tired that day. I completely lost it in my head as to what I had entered as my long passcode, and I had to totally restore from iCloud backup because I didn't save it in my password vault. Had I put it in my password vault like my normal habit is, I could have gone in the password vault via my iPad or my Mac, and gotten the unlock code to my phone, and then I would have been fine. You know,
I've done that a few times, and what I've now done is my habit, sort of my normal way of doing things, is I open up 1Password, I give the title to the thing I'm about to create a password for, I create the password, I put it into 1Password, and then I set it on whatever I'm setting it on.
Yeah, yeah. That way you do it last, yeah.
Yeah.
And you know for a fact you saved it. So that bit me once, and I know what I'm doing.
Oh, no, it's bitten me.
That makes a good example, right? You know, even I could screw it up.
But, oh, everyone. You know. Right. I may as well tell you. But, you know, whenever a new sysadmin starts in work, they're always afraid. And I said, look, I was in here about a year. I deleted every single machine from the Windows domain. It was okay, though, because we had backups.
Ow.
Yeah. A stray star in an LDAP query. That's all it took.
Oh, wow.
Thankfully, we have a nightly backup. Import the LDIF. Everything is back to normal. From me turning bright red and panicking to it being fixed was about 5 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
They were horrible.
It ain't easy being God, is it?
Yeah. You know, but don't worry. You know, everyone makes mistakes. Don't feel bad.
Yeah. But if you've done the proper backup and controls, and you know that they're tested and work, then you can recover from that.
So. Actually, here's a good note to end on. Backup, backup, backup.
Oh, dear God, yes. And use Adam Christensen's rule. If you don't have at least 2 full backups in 2 different locations, it's not a backup.
Yeah. Someone asked, was it 3-2-1, 3 copies, 2 media, 1 offsite?
Yeah, exactly. So whether that's crash plan or you full clone it with carbon copy cloner and go lock it, you know, and rotate them out of your safe deposit box at a bank, whatever, or you've got file transporters replicating to a family member's house, whatever you got to do it.
Yeah, because Macs make it so easy to encrypt external disks, actually what I've settled on is I have a little drive toaster and I have 2 bare drives, which are both encrypted. There's always one of them in my desk and work. There's always one of them here at home. I swap them.
Yep.
And because it's encrypted, it's lying in a place I don't control. But if someone steals it, they have a pile of pseudo-random noise.
Yeah, the best they can do is format it and have a drive they can use.
It is a 4-terabyte drive, so I guess that is worth something. But, I'll live.
Yeah, but that's still a cheap price to pay for your privacy.
Correct. And the way I look at it is, if there's a disaster big enough to destroy my house and where I work, I'm unlikely to be in a position to care.
Very much true.
Okay, well, George, thank you very much for jumping in on this chit-chat across the pond. I really appreciate your time.
It's been great.
It's been too long since I've heard your voice on a podcast, so hopefully we remedy that.
Yeah. Well, I was working for 2 years at a university, and I literally commuted down at the beginning of the week. I had an apartment down there and stayed, and then I come back home. So obviously, you know, that took a lot out of me. So now I actually went the opposite extreme, you know, now that I work from home or from Starbucks or wherever I got Wi-Fi. So,
your commute is like 5 yards?
Yeah. Like I said, it's let the dogs out. Make a pass past the Keurig and then go and then jump down in my chair in front of the Thunderbolt display.
That is actually a universal truth that geeks run off coffee.
Oh, absolutely.
It's, or caffeine, you know, should we say. Could be Coke.
Yeah, yeah.
Coca-Cola now, not...
yeah, yeah, yeah. Not the really old formula.
Yes. Anyway, thank you very much. And do you want to give out any links where people might... I don't know if you still blog. I know you used to do that.
Yeah, I do. But it's obviously a lot of more stuff specific to my job. But if you're interested in like big data and security analytics and stuff like that, georgestarcher.com. And of course, I'm just everywhere as George Starcher, you know, whether it's Twitter or LinkedIn, wherever you can find me. You Google me, you can't miss me.
It's great having an uncommon name, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Except I still wish Google would... Well, that's... Sorry, I just have to go on for a rant.
Oh, God.
There's two identity things I wish would get fixed.
Okay.
Both Google and Apple have the same problem. You can't merge pre-existing accounts into one identity and clean it up.
Oh, tell me about it. Yeah, I have... Because I was one of those weird people who got a .Mac account all those years ago, before I got an iTunes account, I need to have two sets of two-factor auth. One for my iCloud... And one from my iTunes.
Yep, same thing. And what it got worse when with this update to iOS 8, it broke Find My Friends because I had my Find My Friends, all my and my iMessage, all that was on my what technically was my iTunes account.
Yeah.
And I really only used my iCloud account for backing up my device.
Yeah.
I had to flip all that.
I had to do the same actually. Yeah,
because it wouldn't let me log back into the new Find My Friends under my iTunes account and import. I mean, it was just a big mess.
Yeah, because your iPhone is now logged into iCloud and all of the iCloud-y services are sort of centrally authenticated, which is much easier.
Yeah. So, and Google's got the same problem, right? I got an old Google Mail ID, which has my YouTube channel with a lot of old screencasts I did, and I don't want to lose them. And I really want everything under my George at George Starcher, but they don't give you, again, a clean way to merge and clean those up, even if you're perfectly willing to do so. So I wish Apple and Google would fix that.
I'm sure there's a way they could, but it's probably not easy, but I still wish they would.
Yeah, I just don't think it's that high on their radar at the moment.
No, I guess, it doesn't earn them cash. So.
Yep.
Anyway, thank you, George. GeorgeStarcher.com. And... actually, usually I end them by saying, until next time, happy computing. But I guess I can do that. So until next time, happy computing. And that winds up yet another NosillaCast. Thank you very much to everyone who sent in material. You made my life really quite easy, actually. It's very easy to put the show together when people send me in cool stuff. So thank you very much. And as the wonderful Ken Ray would say, you guys rock. Now, if for some strange or weird reason you haven't had enough of Irish accents, maybe you have a quota for the week or something, you can also listen to more of me on let's-talk.ie, which is where I host my two podcasts. They're two monthly shows. The first is called Let's Talk Apple. It's a panel show where we look at the big picture view of the news that relates to Apple in the previous month. And the other is also a panel show. It's called Let's Talk Photography, where we discuss some topic related to the art and craft of photography. If for some reason you're curious what I look like, you can actually find out this week, which is very unusual because I tend to avoid video podcasts, but the wonderful Chuck Joyner talked me into being on a video show. In this case, it was an episode of his Mac Jury series over on the Mac Voices podcast. So it was Chuck, it was myself, it was Don McAllister, and it was Dr. Mac chatting away about all the cool stuff Apple unveiled at their keynote this week. So that is a Mac Jury episode, which is episode 14207 of the Mac Voices podcast. I mean, I know Allison always jokes that Chuck does too many podcasts, but episode 14,207? Wow. Anyway, you'll find that over at macvoices.com. Probably enough of me yammering on now, so let's just end by saying congratulations again to Lindsay and Nolan, and until next time, happy computing!